So it is the 30th of November. I am Rohan Mukherjee and I am with Mr. Karma Shittim, the Secretary of the Gross National Happiness Commission of the Kingdom of Bhutan. So could I ask you to start by providing a brief background of yourself and your work with the government of Bhutan so far?
Well, I've been working with the Royal Government of Bhutan since 1989, and most of my career I spent in the Ministry of Finance. And it's only very recently that I was transferred from the Ministry of Finance to work as the secretary in the Gross National Happiness Commission, which until February last year used to be called the Planning Commission.
Right. And what caused the change of name from the Planning Commission to the Gross National Happiness Commission?
Well, Gross National Happiness has been both the philosophy and vision for the Buddhist approach to development, and the change of the name was a testament to the will to will there is to make sure our development goes in this in line with this philosophy and vision. So basically, the motivation for that change was to, in many ways, ensure that we don't lose sight of what it is we are trying to achieve with development, that we are not just planning for anything, but we are planning for cross-national happiness. So I believe that was the main motivation.
And has that led to any change in the functions of the erstwhile Planning Commission, or is the work pretty much the same?
Yeah, actually, it has led to a lot of changes in the way we do. And the main change I would say is we had to start asking ourselves whether what we were doing was in line with this philosophy and vision of cross-national happiness. And of course, very quickly we found that we were not. What we were doing was more similar to what most governments do. You know, which is focus on the social sectors, the economy, and the environment. And we were also doing that. And clearly we knew that embedded in this concept of cross-national happiness is the idea that you take the benefits of modernization, but also you ensure you retain and you cultivate, nurture all the good things that generations of Buddhists who have gone by have passed down to us. So then we began this serious effort to see how we can ensure that what we are doing is consistent with GNH, that we have tools to ensure that policies we make are consistent with it, etc. So then we actually went down the railroad of basically looking at the concept and philosophy of GNH and breaking it down in ways that can be used as concrete basis for policy making, decision making in the royal government. So that is what we have actually, this name change has actually led us down this path. And since then, I would say we have come a long way. Of course, we are still early days. I'm talking about last year, February, when we were renamed, and it's just been over a year and a half. But we have done a lot in this time.
So, and you were transferred to this body at the time that it was renamed?
Prior to that.
Okay.
I was already there for about 10 months.
I see. Right. And before we talk about how exactly you operationalize the concept of GNH, could you talk a little bit about the history of the concept and its origins?
Well, basically, as far as the origins is concerned, this was something authored by His Majesty the Fourth King, and basically from the first speech His Majesty the Fourth King made when he became a king, he spoke about the need to focus the well-being, the happiness of the people as being the ends of what development should achieve. In terms of the actual usage of the term gross national happiness, I think it surfaced a little later in the 80s. But in terms of the message of the development must focus on the well-being, the happiness of the people, this was there from the very first speech His Majesty the King made when he was enthroned.
And what are the essential components of this idea?
For a long time, of course, His Majesty the Fourth King was actually at the helm of affairs, running the government on a daily basis. So you could say that every act and decision in the royal government was imbued with this vision and philosophy, because the author was many ways running the government. But since 1998, when he devolved the absolute authority from the monarch to a group of ministers, at that time we also had formulated the Vision 2020 document, and at that time we articulated the gross national happiness philosophy further in terms of the four pillars we talk about, which is basically sustainable socio-economic development, preservation, promotion of culture and traditions, good governance, and then the conservation of the environment. So these are the four pillars, and this has guided, you could say, policy making, decision making in Bhutan until now. And if you see flourishing culture and tradition or the rich environment, I would say it's no accident. It is because the government pursued, and every decision maker had these four pillars in the back of their minds when they were making decisions, etc. But it was not there spelled out in a concrete framework. And this is then the next set of work we set out to do after we were renamed as the Gross National Happiness Commission.
And could you talk a little bit about that process? How did you actually translate these concepts and philosophy into tangible outputs and outcomes for the planning or the Gross National Happiness Commission?
Well, this is very much work in progress, but I can tell you what we did is, firstly, the 10th five-year plan, we plan on a five-year cycle, and the 10th five-year plan, we had this idea about less focus on results, on outcomes. So results-based management. As the objective from which we can draw further than all the efforts of the government. And we said, what would be the measure of that? We said it must be a set of indicators which approximates this concept we call gross national happiness. So this is something, if you read our plan document, it is there. So basically, this is the way we started the thought process in terms of going from four pillars, which is still very broad to be able to give, not able to give specific guidance. So we said, no, we must break it down further and have those as almost like a compass to guide our development. So that is then the next body of work we did is through a nationwide survey. What we did is, we were very clear among ourselves that, look, while it's the pursuit of gross national happiness, it does not mean actually trying to really focus on happiness as such, because that is too difficult to lend itself to a framework for policy making. That must always be an individual responsibility. But what we said is, we could do an exercise to really uncover all the conditions or determinants for people to lead these happy and hopefully fulfilling lives. So how did we do that? We commissioned a work to our Center for Bhutan Studies, who carried out a nationwide survey, about maybe 1,000 plus respondents. And we asked, something like 300 questions. I think each questioner took over a day to respond to. We gave some compensation to the respondents, because at that time we were just trying to bring on table everything, because we wanted to get a good sense of what is really important to Buddhists, what it is that Buddhists want from development, beyond the usual, the money, the jobs and all that, the conventional things. So after CBS did this, then they mined the data and they studied, etc., and finally they came out with, under the four pillars, nine domains, and which is then further broken down into the domains, you could say, are clusters of like, but eventually 72 indicators. And these 72 indicators, we feel, are a very good approximate of this vision and philosophy of cross-national happiness in terms of aspirations people have from development. And many of these 72, in fact, most are very subjective. And this is one thing we always like to point out. We are not using this to displace all other indicators. All the conventional objective indicators remain. UN Human Development Index, MDGs, GDP, etc. But we use this as the other half. Because most of the indicators measure things we can measure, but a lot of the subjective, the qualitative aspects are not measured precisely because they don't lend itself to measurement. But our work is actually very much about filling up this part of the missing indicator work. And we feel only when you have these two, you get a good sense of, you know, of the real outcome of your effort, you know. It's one thing to keep enhancing life expectancy as a goal in health. But another thing, if you find that the people who are living now from, say, 80 to 100, that the last 20 years they live in miserable condition, I mean, it shows there's something not working. So by having both this, we see the picture always as a whole. And so this is where we are at.
And broadly speaking, these nine clusters, do they fall in a variety of sectors, or are they concentrated more in the social, education, health?
Actually, they fall in all. In fact, I can tell you that they encompass, firstly, what is normally there in every government's policy-making framework. In fact, if my personal view is, this work we have done, and through these nine domains, what we have been able to do is really bring a holistic development agenda. Why do I say that? The reason is, if you find that, if you see the policy-making framework for government, as I mentioned, it always focuses on those economies, the social sectors, health, education, and then the environment, and not very pleasing treatment there too. And usually this is it, and it makes decision based on that. Yet you ask these very individuals who they so-called represent. If you ask individuals, you'll see that, yes, these four are very important, but then there's a whole list of other things which are also equally important, if not even more. Community vitality, cultural diversity, time use, good governance itself, and what is the fifth? And psychological well-being, stress, etc. So what you see is that there is actually a disconnect in the policy-making framework. And by our work, we have actually now, in a sense, bridged the gap, because now our policy-making framework has the conventional things, but we have these other five dimensions. And now, in a sense, we have a much more rounded framework for policy-making, which really takes into consideration what individuals consider important on a daily basis in policy-making. So that way, the framework is, I would say, really holistic. And I think that's the value it can bring.
And these 72 indicators, how often do you measure them to measure your progress?
Now, we did that one survey, and we zoomed in on the 72 indicators, and each indicator has a number. And of course, the sample size is small, and we have to go through all that just now. But the next one we are planning to do, we are looking at least about now, you know, it has to be statistically significant and all that, so we're looking at much larger number, but it will be focused on the 72 indicators. And the idea is every 2 years to do this survey and make the results public. And this work will be entrusted to the National Statistical Bureau, so that it's an independent body which gives these results. So what we see is it could be a very powerful democratic tool. Over and above any political manifesto, you'll have this, you know, set of indicators, and society sees how it's doing on community vitality, on family relationship, and they can see whether government is doing something to improve it or not, and they can question. They can say, look, family relationship index is so poor, you can see trust between people is a problem, especially in urban areas, what are you doing? That will be the challenge to us, and we'll have to get creative. We'll have to allocate resources to say, okay, maybe the best way to do that is, I don't know, introduce neighborhood watch in the police. On the other side, maybe create some new temples in urban centers so they become a social space where people get to know each other, etc. So this would be the way we would use it. So it would lend itself to, you know, use in various ways.
And has there been any attempt to create a sort of composite score of these indicators to see gross national happiness as one figure, as one index?
If you look at the website as it stands just now, which is called www.grossnationalhappiness.com, that's the CBA, Center for Bhutan Studies, is hosting. They have actually done that, made a composite. But we are in talk with them, and we want things kept at the 72 indicator level. Because the idea here is not to measure happiness. Because that's the type of message we don't want to send out. And for us, what we see is the composite number has no meaning. It really is the trend we'll get every 2 years when we do comparison over these numbers and across time. That is the important, that it gives this important feedback, a very rich feedback, in addition to all the objective indicators on how we are really doing. So we feel that the value is at that indicator level, and we are planning to leave it at that, at least from our perspective. Now, whether for as an academic exercise, people will give weights and add it up and then say, Bunis are happy or not, that's another story. But personally, I'm not at all for that.
And were there any surprises in the survey results that you saw of the 72 indicators?
Yes, I would say there were a couple of surprises, and but many actually supported what we sort of intuitively knew. So it's good that now we can move from intuition to at least have some evidence and for our work. In terms of surprises, I did not expect there to be such a strong divide, for instance, on a gender. At the moment, given the size of the sample, beyond gender, we feel it may not be statistically, we cannot draw conclusions, we feel, to comment. But if you look at the gender, there we saw quite a clear divide. Almost on every indicator, females fared a little worse. For only good thing is the gap is not big. But they're always a little harsher, you know, if his income is lower, if his, you know, whatever is a little harder. I think the only area where they fared good, if we interpret that to be so, is in time use. Because in time use, we're looking at the division of time between work, leisure, and rest. Because that's the important, you know. And we saw that women sleep longer than men. Both men and women sleep over 8 hours, so which is very good. But women seem to sleep longer. Maybe this shows some rural bias, because we certainly don't get to sleep that long. But that was one. But the other one surprising I saw was on discrimination. I was surprised to see that there was quite a, lot of respondents feeling that there is discrimination. So again, now we need to, only thing is it was left very broad, you know, it didn't say discrimination based on this or that. It just said discrimination based on, and it listed a whole series, so it doesn't give us helpful, it's not helpful from a zooming in perspective, but it shows there's a problem. So next time certainly we'll also improve that part of the survey to say we want that information to be a bit more specific. But that was quite surprising, because we, both gender and this, we feel we are very, you know, we are quite liberal. We are gender, certainly policies are very gender neutral, and from our perspective, at least compared to the examples around, women enjoy good status in our society for many reasons, you know. In fact, in a large part of the country, matrilineal hereditary systems, etc. So that part we were a little surprised.
And have you made any efforts based on the results of the survey and the indicators that you've developed to now translate that into policy, to coordinate? Have you made any efforts to coordinate with the various ministries?
Yes. Well, related to these indicators, the Center for Bhutan Studies has made us a number of tools. They call it policy screening tools, project selection tools. So these tools ask questions on each of these, and this we have created institutions within the ministry. We have what we call the GNH committees, and their job, whenever there's a policy, is to use that GNH policy screening tool and do some scoring based on that. A group of heterogeneous people, you know, there. And we also here in the commission, we do it ourselves also for that same policy. So as a field testing, we did it on the National Human Resource Development Policy. So we had the ministry do, we did. And both on a GNH perspective, they passed in terms of the score was above the threshold. And scoring was actually similar. But we still see that there's a lot of challenge in using the tools, and we need to refine the way we use tools, etc. But basically what it makes us do is on every policy issue, it makes us ask all these things which are important, impact on time use, on stress, on family relation. And it gets you to think, you know, because others, like I was saying, normally you'll just think, okay, market access, is it good? You know, what does it do for the bottom line? You know, I mean, so this is the value. So we have already started field testing these tools.
And have you set up these GNH committees in every ministry?
Yes.
Since when have they been active?
Actually, the time when we were renamed as GNH Commission, at the same time we set up these committees. Because we had this thought of how we want to do this. And we have what you call a policy formulation protocol. Any policy in the royal government, irrespective of its origin, must go through a set process. And in that, one is the scoring on the GNH policy selection tool. And also there's other mainstreaming things like gender, environment, and all.
And the impetus for renaming the Planning Commission and for setting up these committees, did that come from His Majesty or from
the Cabinet? Yes, from the Cabinet. The executive order came from the Cabinet. But basically reflecting His Majesty's desire to make sure that we really get on this road, in a way where we can really operationalize and be clearer about what will guide us so that we can achieve it faster. So yes, I think that really received a lot of impetus.
And is there any sort of criticism along the lines of that the fact that there are 72 indicators to already add on to the standard set of indicators that every policymaking body has to take care of?
I wouldn't say there are criticisms on the indicators as such. I think what we hear is probably what is there is this misconception people have that now we are trying to measure happiness. And once we actually get into the dialogue and tell them what we're doing, of course, then people realize it's something else and actually quite usefully provides additional feedback which did not exist, etc. So once people know, the receptivity is very good. But when they don't know, a lot of the popular misconception seems to be this indicator work is now going to measure the happiness in Bhutan.
And in terms of the workload of the individuals who are involved in policy making, does this increase it significantly, the fact that they have to go through a policy selection tool that measures all these various things, or...?
Just now we have only field tested it once, so it's difficult to say, but I would imagine once it is in place, it will take up some time, but actually most people feel it is worth it, at least when we did the field testing, because every time people have had this concern that, look, are we seeing GNH and doing un-GNH or doing the normal GTP, say, so at least with this people realize that people feel comfortable that we're talking GNH and now we're really doing, because we evaluate, we look at through this very important lens.
And excuse me, going back to the four pillars of the GNH that you articulated earlier, have you ever come across in operationalizing these four pillars a tension between them? For example, in a lot of places we find economic development is not always conducive to the environment or to culture.
Yes.
And that there can be, you know, all kinds of tensions between these four pillars.
Yes. Well, I can tell you that when we were field testing the GNH tool, the policy selection tool, today one debate is this, whether Bhutan should join WTO or not. So our commission, we were asked to give our views. So as part of forming our views, I met with all my colleagues in the secretariat and I asked them, and we had a discussion and we have a show of hands, should we join WTO or not? And when we had the show of hands, the majority, and it was not a big majority, but still the majority was for joining WTO. So we said, okay, this is what we feel. Now let us use our GNH policy selection tool. So the same group of people, we used the policy selection tool. And the result was failure. We did not pass that hurdle. When we used the GNH policy selection tools, unless we reduce some areas of concern, it basically saying don't join WTO. Now what I got from that was exactly what you're asking, that maybe inherently there is some tension between a philosophy like this, which looks at things much more holistically, and something else which is purely focused about returns and all. And I, in some sense, I guess, it is quite obvious. I mean, intuitively also, you'd imagine there'd be such a tension. But that exercise actually took us through that and made us realize that. And we were actually quite surprised ourselves that, you know, we feel one thing, but when we really look at this thing through the GNH, and where we are weighing it against things which are important to us, then it doesn't pass the test. So since then we have not moved. You know, we are still there.
Okay, so Bhutan is still deliberating. The government is still deliberating.
The government is deliberating, but our secretariat also, we have not been able to then come to a singular view because, you know, and I guess that's the whole value of this. This tool brings. And like I always tell my colleagues, in the end, we may make certain choices even if it does not pass the, you know, even if the GNH policy screening tool tells us otherwise, because options may be limited. But you know now the trade-off very clearly. And I think that's important, because sometimes you may say, no, the trade-off is not worth it, you know.
And on that point, actually, are there instances, obviously you've only piloted this in one ministry, but are there instances where a policy that may contravene the concept or even the practicalities of GNH is still carried out because it's understood to be important from another perspective?
I think that would require then probably more iterations of consultation and addressing the problems of the policy because of which it is not being able to cross the GNH policy hurdle, you know, the threshold for passing. That is the approach we are thinking of just now. That it should not be you just do that test once and leave it. You should go back. And firstly, it could reflect the group of a bias of a group who are doing, because it's very subjective. You know, what is the likely impact of joining WTO on family relationship? What do you think? I think we might have different pictures. So we'll need to record this and then evaluate. And so I think the tool could use a lot of improving. But once it's improved, like I was saying, it makes the trade-off known. And then it's up to decision makers. But now the accountability would be quite high because people know the trade-offs and what you're making. But we feel it will lead to better choices.
And have you made an effort to build up popular support for this kind of these indicators and educate the public about how to interpret?
No, not at the moment, because as I said, we're going down this road till last February is still quite. I mean, we have to be sure and reach a certain level of comfort and have robustness, etc. You know, being able to stand close scrutiny before going further. With the public. But what we are confident is the public GNH in terms of four pillars, that's very widely and well understood. And this is basically just more, you know, concretization of those. So that way we feel confident that what we have, there will be good support. But what we want to make sure is that it lends itself to good use for policy making, etc., for really making good choices.
And what has been the international reception to both GNH as a concept and the new things that you have been doing to operationalize?
Well, here I can just share my personal view, and what I feel is that I would say over the last 4 or 5 years, maybe it's really picking up. The genuine acknowledgement and appreciation that there is really a possible a third approach in a realistic way. Because if you go back like 10 years, I would say, and if you look any reference to GNA, gross national happiness, for example, in The Economist, would always have a sort of very, treat it in a not very serious way. Almost like, they're doing this kind of experiment, with some amount of cynicism, I would say. But now I can see that there's actually been quite a visible change. In fact, one of the recent Economists, when there was an economic focus article on Sarkozy's commission, etc., and then in the last para they mentioned Bhutan doing his work with indicators. And for the first time, I felt that was without any of that cynicism and all. And it was saying that, someone is doing this and in the present, saying it in the right light. So that way, yes, I see now there's an increasing, I think, appreciation, and especially after the Sarkozy Commission. And of course, there have been NGOs, but I think it was good to NGOs like GPI Atlantic, like New Economics Foundation in UK, the Happy Planet Index people, etc. But there was really no one from the mainstream, so it's good to see someone like the French president suddenly, really come out with it, and because otherwise, from a government, central government, I think we were the only one really, saying these things and trying to go down this path. The rest of the players are all think tanks or peripheral. But now it's good to see that there is some interest even among governments, and especially to see it in developed country leaders talking about it. That's good.
All right, I think that pretty much covers everything. Is there anything you'd like to add in conclusion?
No, I can't think of anything.
All right, thank you very much.
No, thank you.